The views and opinions expressed during the drive time are those of Dave Glover and his guests and are not those of Northumberland 89.7. Agree, disagree, or have a comment? Call the station and speak with Dave live on the air. Call 905-372-2321. That's 905-372-2321. Now your host, Dave Glover.
Thank you, Wendy, and welcome back to the show. It is the 6 o'clock hour. It is Wednesday. That means it's time for Consider This with my special guest, Rob Washburn, who is the professor of e-journalism at Loyalist College. We will be talking about so many things that are happening. I want to talk about the Lord's Prayer, the Supreme Court's decision today. We here in this little community of ours have had to wrestle with this idea as well. Before that, here's Harry Nilsson and our new theme song, Everybody's Talking.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stopping still. I can't see their faces. Only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze. And skipping over the ocean like a stone. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Everybody's talking at me, can't hear a word they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. I won't let you leave my love behind. No, I won't let you leave.
Harry Nilsson, everybody's talking here on Northumberland 89.7, and we're talking. First thing I want to talk about is this idea of the Lord's Prayer, and Supreme Court of Canada, in a unanimous decision, said there must be a stringent separation of church and state. By having the Lord's Prayer recited, or any prayer recited at a state function, which they would consider a municipal government as a state function, that there needs to be a separation of church and state. It's required under the law. And so they flat out today banned the Lord's Prayer in municipal council. Now, Port Hope, of course, they banned their Lord's Prayer after official proceedings in Port Hope as a result of a human rights complaint. It was a procedural bylaw, and they brought it in to amend it. And the bottom line is, as Mayor Thompson said at the time, she has no issue with this. She said it's a sign of the times. She took the opportunity to voice her displeasure with the times that would discourage the use of traditional greetings such as Merry Christmas, and wondered what would happen should council instead decide to open meetings with the singing of O Canada. Well, I personally wouldn't have a problem with them singing O Canada, although I'm sure. Although the group we have here in Cobourg, they got some pretty good pipes. I think they could probably pull off a pretty good version of O Canada. What do you think of that, Rob?
I can't make judgment on the capacity for our counselors to sing. So I won't say anything about that at all, Dave. But on the issue of prayer, I certainly certainly a welcome decision today and an important one. I think it's been a trend across many municipalities. I know Coburg a couple years ago, they also stopped saying the Lord's Prayer, although they've offered a few moments of silence at the beginning of the council meetings to reflect before they start. I'm not sure what they do up in Hamilton Township. But I guess the thing is, Dave, why is it necessary to even have a moment of reflection? Why can't we just go and do our business? I wonder why that is. What do you think's behind it?
Well, I think it's a throwback, actually, to our, you know, our white Anglo-Saxon Protestant roots, the whole idea of community being a faith-based community. So, I mean, let's face it, it was organized religion for the most part that got a lot of these communities together and, mm-hmm. and got them working. Everyone was working out of the same parish. But as Linda Thompson says, I mean, we've evolved and our democracy has evolved. And we've evolved. Some would say we've devolved, actually. If you hear LeVar Payne and any of those fellows from the Conservative Party of Canada or folks who walked out of it saying that they believe that Christianity is under attack. And even Linda Thompson kind of alluded to that in her response by being upset about the whole Merry Christmas. I think when it comes to government, there needs to be a strong separation of church and state. I don't believe we should be doing it. As far as the reflection time at the very beginning, I don't know what folks are reflecting on. They're at a council meeting. You know, so again, I don't see the need for either the Lord's Prayer or a moment of reflection. And the mayor of Ottawa has announced that he's going to be introducing a moment of reflection at his council meetings, too. What are they reflecting on?
Well, maybe to have wisdom and to judge equally and fairly all matters before them. I don't know. Maybe it's just
handled in the swearing
well,
in.
But you know what? Maybe it's just nice to have a couple of minutes after a busy day just to be quiet and before you go in and mm-hmm. start doing municipal business. I know a lot of these people are busy through the day, so maybe it's just a nice chance to calm themselves down before they jump into the political fray.
A little great, maybe a couple of moments of
some green tea, be all nice.
Well, exactly. Well, we know that. I mean, some council meetings, not necessarily with either of these two councils as yet, have been pretty raucous. So they definitely would definitely want to take a couple of moments before you move through the agenda, I guess. Particularly if there's things that are going to be coming up that you don't necessarily agree or want to discuss. I mean, I don't really believe that we need a moment of reflection. I think we should get right to the business at hand, which is the governance.
But it's interesting. I wonder what the listeners think about this kind of thing, because I know a lot of people do feel strongly. And I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if you were to go down to the Legion or you were to visit any seniors home and you were going to talk to people, they would feel very, very strongly that this is part of the culture. But I think it also reflects, as you mentioned, on a different time and a different approach to governance. And you know, at those in those times, you know, 50, 60, 70, 100 years ago, it was important to, or not unusual to express your faith. And most of the people in the community were of the same faith. So it really wasn't out of place. But I think in modern Canada, it's good to see that the Charter and the Supreme Court has upheld this.
Well, and let's not forget that this was brought forth by a complaint from an atheist, a person who is mm-hmm. a non-believer. Well, I think even non-believers believe in something, though. You know, even if they believe in nothing, there's still that belief of nothing.
Well, you know what, Dave? I came to talk politics and not religion, which were two things my grandmother said never to talk about in public. So,
and two things that shouldn't really go hand in hand. Clearly, the Supreme Court of Canada agrees with that. Now, the Supreme Court of Canada this week also struck down mandatory minimums for handguns. And I wanted to pick your brain over that issue because it was a split decision. It was a 4-3 decision. Ms. McLaughlin, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, if you will, she's the one who delivered the majority ruling on that. But they said the problem with mandatory minimums with handguns is that occasionally you can snare the wrong people. I mean, she said, so if you are a person who inherited a handgun, for instance, and you haven't had the opportunity to just get down and have that gun registered, if it's found on your person or within your premises as an unregistered gun, you face a minimum 3-year mandatory sentence. At least that's what you would have faced under Harper's regime. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's unconstitutional. It's cruel and unusual punishment. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think I don't have a lot that I can say about that, to be quite candid. I mean, the handgun issue in terms of the Supreme Court, I thought it was a fair decision. And I don't know what to say more than that. I'll just say that I thought it was a fair decision. I think it is ambivalent, and I think this is just another example of poor legislation that has been ill considered. And I think we've seen a number of cases that have gone before the Supreme Court that have been problematic for this government because they have not done their due diligence and done their homework. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, yet another time when we are looking at poor legislation that gets slapped down by the Supreme Court.
Well, some have argued, even in John Iverson's editorial yesterday, he argued that this was the politicization of our Supreme Court, and now we have a very political Supreme Court, and that they're not the ones who should be drafting legislation. They're the ones to ensure that the laws are followed. But as part of their mandate, I mean, as with the separation of church and state, there's also a preeminent mandate from the Supreme Court of Canada to ensure that all laws are just, right? I mean, that's part of the Constitution.
Absolutely.
That's part of the reality. Now, some say that their arguments really didn't hold water. The three dissenting judges said, you know, this was not really within their purview, that they were ultimately splitting hairs. But the reality is people are getting ensnared. Now, the two cases that were brought before the Supreme Court from the appellants, one involved a guy who hadn't had his gun registered. He had no criminal offenses prior in his lifetime. The other guy was a repeat offender, and this was the mandatory minimums of 5 years for repeat offenders. So the perspective of the Supreme Court pretty much was that if someone's going to commit a crime with a gun, it doesn't matter if there's a minimum mandatory or not. They're going to commit a crime with a gun. It's that simple.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that even jurisdictions, certain law and order jurisdictions like Texas, for instance, which is a state that I would argue that the ruling conservatives have taken a lot of their really heavy-handed jurisprudence from the state of Texas. Even the state of Texas is pulling back from that plateau, and they're saying that mandatory minimums don't work, that the recidivism rates have actually dropped when they gotten rid of mandatory minimums, and they're instead of building more prisons, they're building fewer prisons. I mean, what the Supreme Court said was this is just another fast track to get more people into the penitentiary.
Well, and I think your point about the politicization of the Supreme Court is a really good one. I think that the Supreme Court has to be at arm's length from Parliament, and they're there to ensure that our charter rights are not infringed. And I think that it's absolutely critical that they be allowed to do what they do. And what worries me more than anything is that, you know, first of all, it's a demonstration of the quality of the legislation coming out of Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes in and the Supreme Court is having to make judgment on it like this, then I think that it's a failure of Parliament, not of the Supreme Court. But also, I think that it's part of an overall strategy by this government to corrode the institutions that are important. They've done this many times with the Supreme Court. They've done it with Parliament, you know, the way they handle the budget, as they did just most recently. They make their budget announcement. They don't do it in Parliament where there can be debated and talked about.
Mm-hmm.
They take it out to Tim Hortons or to a gas station or some other place.
Or in the case just recently of Canada Goose, the Canada Goose manufacturing.
Absolutely. And they make the budget announcement, which I think erodes the importance of these institutions in the minds of Canadians. And so I think it's just part of a larger strategy to deride these important institutions that are so critical to our democracy,
mm-hmm.
rather than and that's the crime here. If there's going to be any crime, I think that's the crime.
Well, and I have to concur with you on that assessment. I mean, what we have seen is a government that has, well, first of all, they maligned and decided to discredit and undermine the Senate of Canada by appointing people who they knew, quite frankly, didn't qualify. I mean, let's face it, Mike Duffy doesn't live in PEI, folks. I hate to break it to you. He's got a nice cottage there, but that doesn't make him a resident.
Really?
You know? And the reality is the way the way the Senate rules are, it looks as though that's not even a breach here, according to this government. And we know from talking to some ex-conservative legal experts who've come out and publicly said, look, the only smell test they have is a 5% rule, which is as long as 5% of the legislation is all that we can expect to be turned back, we're doing good. And I mean, we've seen this with the prostitution laws. We saw this with the safe injection sites. We saw this with regards to, well, their complete disregard to missing and murdered Aboriginal women in this country. We've seen the lack of oversight. We've seen government remove restrictions and allow industry to regulate itself. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen the dismantling of the Navigable Waters Act, an act that was in effect from 1885, listeners, where we protected over 1 million bodies of water. So you're absolutely right. I mean, your depiction of this government is one where they try to, if they can't discredit something, they'll demean it, and then they'll do everything they can to tear that down. They've done that with the Senate. They're doing it with the Supreme Court of Canada. I mean, he's already come out. And I mean, if it wasn't for parliamentary privilege, I'm sure we wouldn't hear from the Prime Minister on this issue. But he's already said in the House of Commons, where he has parliamentary privilege, that the Supreme Court of Canada is acting well beyond their duties. But their duties are to the Constitution. And what this government doesn't appreciate is that thanks to our Constitution, thanks to our Charter, is that the law of the land is paramount. It used to be that parliamentarians were the ones who ran the show. What they said goes. But since we've had our Constitution, and it's 25 years old, I think now, or 20-odd years old, 30-something years old, 1982 is when it was repatriated, right?
That's correct.
So 33 years on, and yet we've got a government that hasn't even celebrated that. This government would rather celebrate the lost Franklin expedition, an expedition that occurred years before this Confederation was even born. They've tried to rewrite the history of the War of 1812. I mean, they've done everything they can to try and create a past history for this country. But what they've forgotten to do is focus on the current and the future.
Absolutely.
So we're gonna keep our eyes on these folks, and we're gonna keep watching what they're doing. And again, kudos to the Supreme Court of Canada once again. Now, there's been another body that's been getting a lot of disparaging comments made, and that's mainly from the markets, and that is the Bank of Canada. And folks are not happy with Stephen Pelosi's decision to keep interest rates at 0.75%. They're saying that the economy is moving well enough now that they can increase the prime rates, and that they're thereby increasing rates at the primary lending institutions where you and I do business. But I'm arguing, and I've gotten some support on this, I've been arguing on Twitter about the fact that Stephen Pelosi realizes that Canada's economy isn't in recovery. I think Stephen Pelosi is fully cognizant of what's coming out from the OECD, the International Monetary Fund. Even the numbers that are coming from StatsCan, they're showing the growth is far below what was expected. We're not even close to the 2.2% that was expected. And that Stephen Pelosi, I think, is doing a yeoman service on behalf of Canadians, even though I'm not happy with the role of the Bank of Canada currently. I think he's doing yeoman service. I mean, what we're trying to do, of course, is avoid crazy inflation. And we're trying to make sure that the Canadian dollar remains competitive. And how do we do that? We do that by, you know, toeing the line, as it were.
Well, and also I think he also said that they anticipate zero growth for the first quarter, but they're expecting by the year's end that it'll hit somewhere around 2%, mm-hmm. which, you know, like good economists are like good weathermen, you know, they make it up as they go along, I guess. But certainly there is no sign that we're in a time of recovery. I think there was a report released last week mm-hmm. about employment where they were talking about 7-8% youth unemployment in the country that is mm-hmm. not being reflected in the unemployment stats that are being released by the government, that unemployment is much worse than it actually is being reported to us. And I just think that the economy is not where it needs to be. And I mean, you just need to look around us at the local economy to see how that plays out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens this year as the students now are coming home and starting to look for summer jobs, or what are going to be the opportunities for these young people to find jobs and to make money as they try to prepare to go back to school. And what about those who are graduating? You know, what sort of employment rates can they expect after they get their degrees and diplomas? I mean, it's a little bit scary. I think if you live in an urban area, I don't know if that makes much of a difference, but I believe mm-hmm. it does. But anybody that's living in rural Canada, I think they're certainly suffering right at the moment, and I think that there needs to be more done on that front.
Well, the big concern, of course, is consumer debt. And we know that the jobs that have been created for the most part, the 1.2 million net new jobs that the government loves to talk about, are for the most part in the service sector, very few in what they would call high-paying echelon. And we're talking about people who are working just to keep the lights on. And what they're saying now, a new report that just came out today, is that the ratio of household debt to disposable income is at an all-time high. And that on average, consumers pay $1.63 for every hour of work, thank God they're not making only $1.63, on consumer credit and debt. So there's a large portion of money going out there. While debt growth has peaked, the Bank of Canada's surprise January rate cut added fuel to the fire, expecting the cooling of housing markets, at least in Alberta. But, I mean, the reality of the situation is we aren't getting any better off. I mean, when the economic downturn occurred, I'm going to call it what it was, which was a depression. It wasn't a recession. It was a depression. We have not seen that type of mass employment since the 1930s. And this government has done nothing comprehensive to help out the working man. What they've done is offered tax breaks to large corporations. They've reduced the oversight necessary. They've allowed industry to regulate itself, and all in an effort to reduce their overhead costs, their operating costs, so that they would in turn hire and train new workers. But that hasn't happened.
Well, I also think that, too, when you talk about the economy, it was said today that oil prices are still hurting mm-hmm. the economy overall. And up till now, other sectors just have not risen. They are rising, but they have not risen to the point where they've made up that difference in terms of productivity and in terms of their contribution to the economy. So I think these are tough times that we're facing. And as we get ready to go into a federal election, the key questions are going to be, what are people's platforms going to be? What party platforms are going to be? And how are they going to impact us on a local level? We've got you look at what's going on right now in the downtown. I mean, there's some really exciting initiatives down there
mm-hmm.
Trying to get those stores filled. I think there's some real innovation and they're trying new things, which is wonderful to see. And I understand they've already received some applications for businesses to move into those stores.
Mm-hmm. But they've got that Win the Space competition.
Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about,
the Win the Space. Yes, thank you. But in the meantime, overall, structurally, how are we doing economically? And
mm-hmm.
When you look at the strategic plan, they talk in very broad terms. There's not a lot of specifics in there that point towards what we're going to do locally to improve our own economy. I mean, and within the context of the larger economy, as we're talking about, how is that going to play out? It's all very dubious right at the moment.
It sure enough is. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back on the other side with more of the Drive Time, more of Consider This Live here on Northumberland 89.7. And welcome back to the Drive Time here on Northumberland 89.7. I'm your host, Dave Glover. Joining me, Rob Washburn, professor of e-journalism at Loyalist College. He's our regular contributor here on Consider This. Well, we've talked a lot about this in a few other shows. Mental health and addiction agencies in Peterborough and the Peterborough-Kawartha district area, that includes us down here, by the way, folks, are about to get more than $1 million in provincial money. Now, this is an announcement from April 10th, so it's a few days old, but this is a crucial investment. $1,162,900 expected to be shared by the Peterborough City County, Northumberland County, the City of Kawartha Lakes, and Haliburton. It's crucial investment that's making mental health... Today, Jeff Leal said at the announcement Thursday at the Forecast Agency on Hunter Street, some of the funding is going to increase after-hours support for people in mental health and with addictions, issues about homeless as well in Peterborough, but it's also going to provide mental health and substance abuse caseworkers in emergency rooms, as well as outreach services to Indigenous communities. Money is also going towards programs that allow patients to see clinicians, my goodness, via telemedicine networks. The idea is to provide more services to keep people out of hospitals. It's about investing in the community so they don't have to go to the hospital in the first place. It's really about trying to keep more and more people in their homes, in their communities, said Dr. Ian Daw. He's a physician in chief for the Ontario Shores Center for Mental Health in Whitby. Now, people live their lives, have their crisis far longer and far more inconveniently timed than that, he said, as far as working within regular hours. It's going to be about direct counseling and support. It's going to be at 8 p.m., between 8 and 10 p.m., he says. It doesn't matter what time of the day it's going to be available. Having spent most of his career in emergency rooms where people suffering from mental health issues and addictions often end up, Daw said it's thrilling to see funding concreting over the gaps in the services that have long existed. Support comes from the Ontario Comprehensive Mental Health and Addiction Strategy, and it's being handled by the Central East Local Health Integrated Network. That's our local LIN, listeners. So more money going to provide services. It's a tough time, though. I mean, we've got the NHH right now going through budgetary review. They're operating at a deficit. I was talking earlier about the announcement being made about the people getting together in Brighton and Quinty West to talk about what's happening through there, Lynn. Part of the problem, of course, with this riding for Northumberland and Quinty West is we have two separate Lynns, right? We have the Central East Lynn, and then we have the Eastern Ontario Lynn, which is part of Quinty West. So in terms of providing service from our MPP, Lou's got his hands full. Let me tell you, he's got two jurisdictions. But I brought up the point earlier about the fact that, you know, even the NHH, which is doing its consultations right now, it doesn't appear as though they're talking to frontline workers, though. And do you think that's because the frontline workers aren't necessarily on the same page as them because of their union affiliation, or is it just because they can't be bothered?
I can't presuppose on any of that. First of all, I you must be pleased about this mental health money. I mean, you know, we've talked before. We've had guests on here, and I know, Dave, you've gone really hard at this issue about providing sufficient mental health money. So I just think that's really, really good news. And what's hard to understand sometimes is how that money flows through, because, you know, we are looking at a hospital that's got a deficit, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden, out of this one pot of money, boom, comes forward this million-plus dollars that is going to go into the community and start to bolster local services. Mm-hmm. And it's also good to hear that, you know, they're breaking out of this nine-to-five mold, this nine-to-five mentality where, you know, well, if it doesn't happen between then, it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's also good to recognize, and I know in talking to people at Northumberland Hills Hospital, they're well aware of the fact that the emergency room is becoming a place where people are coming as a place of last resort to get help when they've got mm-hmm. Addiction crises or mental health crises. So this is all good. And I know they're trying to find creative solutions. So all that's good stuff. Now, as far as the deficit goes and who's being spoken to, I think one of the key pieces of this puzzle is that we've got to remember that the Lynn is driving this bus heavy. And when Lou says whether it's in Quinty West or whether it's in at Northumberland Hills Hospital here in Northumberland, West Northumberland, it's about these people putting the jackboot on the throats of local administrators, saying, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to have to cut, you're going to have to make the changes, you're going to have to slash and burn until we're satisfied that it's to where it needs to be. And I think the thing that we all need to worry about when it comes to this is that the Lynn is in up to its shoulders, tinkering with our system, and we don't. There's no transparency. I mean, they may be talking to user groups, and maybe they're talking to some and not to others. But certainly, we haven't got a sense yet that there's been public consultation, that this is a transparent process. That, you know, we what is on the table and what is being threatened to be cut. I mean, I what worries me is I think in the weeks to come we're gonna all of a sudden there's gonna be this big announcement, and it's going to be, we're losing this, we're doing this, we're hacking this, we're doing that, we're bringing in this model, we're doing that model. I mean, we saw it down in Belleville at the hospital down there, where they just came out and said, you know, here, we're going to lose all these nurses, we're going to bring in other types of personal support workers and these types of people, and, you know, this is a good thing, and yada, 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 yada. And, you know, people never got a chance to even blink, to let alone to have input on what kind of services and what is it mm-hmm. that we really need and what are the things that are good. It's always being rolled out, and then we're being told after the fact, well, you know, give us your opinions about, you know, what you'd like to do with what's ever left over.
That's true. They never ask, what would you like us to do? They always ask, how have we done?
Well,
you know, it's always after the fact.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I also think, you know, the poor people in the administration and on the boards of these organizations. I mean, I really feel for them, because what can they do? They can't come out publicly and say anything. If anything gets leaked, I mean, it looks like they've committed treason.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, the community is being you know, shanghaied and dragged along as they make decisions, and then we just get the mm-hmm. after effect of, you know, well, here's what we're done, here's what's being done. So, you know, these are tense times, you know, and it's so hard, because on one hand, you know, we're seeing this good money for mental health services, and yet at the same time, you know, what can we expect in the weeks to come as the final I's are being dotted and T's crossed as the
provincial budget gets ready to come down. Yeah.
That's right, and we hear what the Lynn has finally decided as the fate for our hospital. Mm-hmm.
Well, the sad reality for most of us is that what we're going to see is increased user fees. That tends to be the big solution for in a lot of these cases. You know, I mean, we already have people up in arms about having to pay to park at the hospital, and yet if the hospital lost that revenue, who knows what where they would have to make cuts.
What's even worse, I think, is that, you know, and I don't believe this is done consciously, but I think people get sent home too quickly, you know, the desire to admit. You know, there's got to be pressures in behind doctors and administrators. You know, do mm-hmm. we open up a bed and let somebody have it? Or, you know, we have these prescribed amounts of time that somebody is. And then, okay, let's get them home and community care will take care of them. And oftentimes there isn't the smooth flow of services mm-hmm. from hospital to home and making sure that people are getting the support that they need so that they can be home and be safe and be happy. Mm-hmm. And healthy. And, you know, again, you know, where are the statistics that say, you know, how many times do people have to come back after the fact? Or how many times do people have to visit before they get a correct diagnosis or whatever?
You brought up the community care aspect, and that's something mm-hmm. that's very important, because if you're a person who's being seen, for instance, at the Quinte West Health Center, you know, if you've had a surgery there, if you've had a procedure there, and now they're sending you home, but you live here in the Eastern Central Lynn, you don't live in the same Lynn. So coordinating services for you from that other Lynn to this Lynn, especially when it comes to community care, can often be just a minefield.
It's scary. Mm-hmm. It's scary. I actually went through that. I had hip surgery done in Belleville and had to come home, and it was a real trial. But you know what? A lot of good people stepped up, and mm-hmm. you know, I have to give credit to a lot of the frontline workers, because when given the challenge, they stepped up and they made things happen. Mm-hmm. But had it been left to the bureaucrats, I mean, it was just absolutely terrifying.
Well,
and
thankfully, you were able to speak up too, right? I mean, what about the people who can't put together cogent thoughts, for instance, who are, you know, maybe they're suffering from dementia or something else, and they're not able to come up with the proper arguments. I mean, maybe they won't get the help.
Yep, but again, I think that's because the Lynns treat these like fiefdoms, and mm-hmm. it's their kingdom, and they're doing what they want to do. And I mean, here in East Central, I mean, we're run out of Scarborough. I mean, we don't even have representation on the board, and how are we supposed to have a voice at these things? I mean, mm-hmm. one of the big changes that needs to be made is that these need to be elected bodies, so that we can send representatives that will go down and fight for our end of things, and not mm-hmm. expect you know, their benevolence to be showered upon us and give us a chance. Otherwise, you know what? I think the hospital boards, what function do they serve? You know, they end up being the whipping boys,
right? Well, it reminds me a lot of the way MPAC is run. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. municipalities basically counselors can say, hey, you know what? You know, your property assessment, that's out of our hands. That's MPAC, you know, and we've got to raise mm-hmm. the rates according to MPAC. And who's this mysterious MPAC? So it really has afforded local councilors across the province the ability to say, hey, you know what? We're not responsible for that. That's MPAC. But, and again, who is MPAC?
To
right?
talk to any school board trustee, and they'll tell you how heavily the provincial government manipulates what goes on at for education mm-hmm. In our area, because it's been dictated from Queen's Park or from Toronto. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to live with whatever is being decided here. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, we heard about all the layoffs that are pending coming up in the new year because of declining enrollment. And, mm-hmm. You know, it's horrible. And this is the education of our children, our future generation. And we have very little to say. I mean, how many parents truck up to Peterborough to attend a school board meeting? And yet it used to be just around the corner down in the east end of Cobourg. You go.
Yeah, there really needs to be more of a community element when it comes to the provision of these services with health care, education, or even property tax assessments.
School councils, I mean, God bless all the parents and the volunteers that go out and do the wonderful programs that these people do, and they raise incredible amounts of money. But at the same time, they don't have any say in policy or procedure.
They don't even have a say in how that money's spent.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, where's the democracy in that? How mm-hmm. are we having an influence on mm-hmm. the education of our children?
Well, I remember when that sort of came to a head with parent associations. My wife was an active member of the parent association in Scarborough, where my son was attending school. And he was attending school in an area that was relatively affluent. And so they were able to raise quite a bit of money. They were looking to put a computer lab in the school, and they raised quite a bit of money. They were going to be able to purchase 5 full computer lab stations for the public school that he was attending. And then Mike Harris's government came along and said, whoa, wait a minute now. You know, this creates disparity in the different schools. And, you know, this, just because your family, your school can raise this money, the school that's down the road, they're not able to raise this money. There's a disparity in the education that the kids are going to receive. And it's just a matter of one neighborhood to the next. So they decided they were going to pool all of those monies that were raised in those districts and say that money's going to go into a central pool. And so you know what happened? The parent association at my son's school disbanded. And they didn't. They took all that money and they dispersed it before the decision had come down, and they went and spent it on something else because they needed to spend it quickly. And they didn't raise any more money. They decided to stop doing it because they were doing it to make the betterment of the education services at their school better. I mean, it would be like, you know, we have the Northumberland Hills Hospital Foundation, and they raise millions of dollars every year to keep our hospital going, to buy new equipment and all of that. What if the provincial government was to say, well, you know, you groups are creating disparity across the province. It looks as though we're going to have to pool all of your resources and make sure that money gets doled out in a fair and equitable fashion. How much money do you think the Northumberland Hills Hospital Association would be able to raise at that point?
None. But I will say this. If you followed the Toronto Star article that appeared just recently about the disparity between the various schools in Toronto mm-hmm. and greater the GTA area, and you saw that map and you looked at all the schools in the affluent areas have been able to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars. Mm. Meanwhile, schools in some of the poorer areas of the city were only able to raise a few thousand dollars. And that's what you're talking about right now. And, yep. and it would be fascinating to do a similar investigative piece out here, because I'm sure you'd find that, you know, there are certain schools in certain maybe towns or villages where they're able to raise sufficient funds to mm-hmm. get new playground equipment or buy books for the library mm-hmm. or whatever else it is that they wish to do. And then other schools, I'm sure, that are unable to raise the same levels of funds. There's no doubt that there's disparity. And mm-hmm. I mean, that's...
Well, in our local area, yep. I can think of just between Coburg and Colborne. Mm-hmm. I know that Colborne does not have the same fundraising capability, and they are a less affluent community, if you will. You can tell that by the cost of rent in the different communities. I mean, that's a pretty good indicator, listeners. And you're absolutely right. I mean, they could do a year-long fundraising program in Crammy to raise money for the Colborne Public School, and that's the same amount of money that would be raised in a quarter in this town, and even in Port Hope.
But I at the heart of all of this, I think my point was that, you know, these institutions need to be more democratized. There needs to be more equality. We don't need them run out of Queen's Park, and we don't need anybody coming down and telling us what we need for our community. It should be the other way around. And what really worries me about what's going on with Mr. Rinaldi right now, in both Quinte West and here in Northumberland, is that there is just a gross inaction of really trying to find out what it is. Or at least give us transparency. Tell us what's going to be cut before it's cut. Tell us what's on the table. Tell mm-hmm. us what we're going to lose, and then at least let us stand a chance and to hear our voices and to have our input. That's what's got to be done. And you know, it's not the local hospital's fault, I don't think, as much as everybody would like to blame them. I really do think that these Lynns are just the most undemocratic, unaccountable group of people getting away with bloody murder.
Mm-hmm. Well, according to the piece, and this was from Valerie McDonald in Northumberland Today, I mean, Eric Hoskins, he said, at the direction of Eric Hoskins, a panel has been struck to develop a plan to address how hospitals in the region can work together to deliver acute health care programs and services in a way that meets the needs of local residents. So there's talk from the health minister that they're looking to meet the needs, but there isn't any talk about how those needs are going to be met.
Well, and you know what? The Lynns will tell you, oh, our meetings are open. You can come and you can watch, but you can't have a delegation.
Mm-hmm.
They won't hear what you have to say. They're not interested. When they want to do a consultation, they'll go out, they'll do a survey. And you know how surveys work. I mean, you know, we can talk to whom we want to talk to. We're not necessarily going to get the reflections of everybody. And as you were mentioning earlier, you know, we don't know who's being spoken to, who's getting to have an input. You know, is it the non-union members are getting more say than the union members? We don't know. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure these are good people and they're well-intentioned and they're trying to do the best they can under the circumstances. But until these things become public, until these things are transparent, mm-hmm. then how are we supposed to know? And that's the part that I think that really has to be addressed.
Well, no, you make it's a salient point, folks, because the reality is this. The Lynn has a very clear mandate. This is how much money you're going to get. Make it work. That's what the province says to the LIN. And then the hospitals are told, well, this is what your budget's going to be this time around. And, I mean, this idea of working together, I mean, we talked about the problems with trying to create an integrated system here because we've got Quinty West, which is in a separate LIN from the Northumberland Hills Hospital, which is in a separate LIN. I mean, you know, so does that mean that Northumberland Quinty West and Northumberland Hills Hospital is supposed to coordinate its services with Whitby then or with Lake Ridge or with Scarborough Rouge, which has completely different demographics?
But let's take the example of Leamington, where they are closing the obstetrics unit, mm-hmm. and now all of a sudden, you know, if your wife suddenly goes into labor, they have to get in and drive 45 minutes to an hour, and that's mm-hmm. on a good day, under good circumstances. Now, you know, take a February storm or a blizzard mm-hmm. or, you know, a bad rain in the spring, and all of a sudden you're driving down, and you and I have been through this. I know, you know, we both have kids, and any parent, I mean, they can tell you lots of stories about getting to the hospital mm-hmm. when, you know, the wife went into labor, and these are tense moments. And if something goes wrong, mm-hmm. I mean, this is not the healthcare system that we dream of. And, you know, I think, you know, my greatest fear is, you know, we're going to see that here. We're going to see the obstetrics unit close. You know, maybe you know, a cardiologist will come down once a week. And then if you want the specialists, then you're going to have to go mm-hmm. up there. I have a good friend right now who's going through a big medical challenge, and the whole family's got to go to Kingston because that's the only place where the surgeons that are available, they were able to go. And it, you know, how can we do this to people? Mm-hmm. You know, I understand at some level we can't do everything here, but you know, we need to have that choice, and we need to be able to make those choices as a community, not as one group imposing on others.
Well, it reminds me of the story Tommy Douglas used to tell before socialized medicine about the young family whose child was gravely ill. They drove the child to the doctor. The doctor couldn't see them. They didn't have any money. The child was then taken en route to a hospital where they had a free hospital in the area in Saskatchewan. And while they were en route to the hospital, the child died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're saying, well, we have universal health care in this country. We have nationalized Medicare. And yet, you know, you're telling me stories about families that have to drive to Kingston in order for them to get the health services they need. And they've got to bring their family with them. I mean, who's going to pay for those other costs? Who's going to be paying for where they stay while they're in Kingston? I mean, there's no affordability there. So, again, it goes to, yes, we'll provide you with the raw service, but everything else is going to come at a price. But we've got a provincial government right now with a huge deficit. We know that healthcare is 47% of the budget presently. It's well on its way to becoming half and half of every dollar earned going to healthcare. How do we fix this? I mean, is this something that needs to be dealt with at the federal level? And do we need to see more money at the federal level? Or do we need to find efficiencies? And in finding efficiencies, that means we have to talk to everybody who's involved in the process.
Well, I'm not against change, and I hope that that's not what it sounds like, because certainly we do have to deal with these things. But to come in and start to impose systems and to not recognize when there's gaps between, you know, community care and the hospital, and you know, we see this is most obvious in the way that we treat these long-term patients that are in the hospital, and we can't find space for them in the community to be looked after that's affordable. So the pieces have to be in place. If we're going to have this system, let's get the pieces in place. Let's make sure that there are no gaps. When there are gaps, let's fund those gaps to make sure that the people are being looked after. I don't think that it's wrong to make change. And, you know, there's lots of good ideas out there, and there's lots of systems that work. But, you know, communities need to find solutions. And the only way that you can go forward in a positive way is when everybody's sitting around the table, everybody feels included, everybody's being listened to, and we move forward step by step. And in the meantime, if it means that it's going to cost half the budget, then so be it. It costs half the budget. That's why we pay taxes. I'd much rather have them being spent on something like that than you know, we're sitting around worrying about whether beer is going to be sold in a grocery store. Good God. I mean, we've wasted so much time, so many resources, you know, screwing around on something that is absolutely ridiculous. And yet, this is a big issue and, you know, gets lots of play and lots of time because it's
a sexy issue.
Well.
It's one of those media sexy issues. Oh, well, we've got people who are up in arms about this, and they're more up in arms about this than they are about X, Y, and Z. But again, you know, I mean, something as basic as a rape kit at our local hospital. I mean, you and I have talked about this before. I mean, these are services that are required within our community. You know, and this goes back to having the conversation, you know, communication through education. And you can't just tell people this is what we're doing, because in a free thinking democracy, people want to know why. You know, recently we had the decision to move the public works facility in Cobourg. There was a decision presented at council and it was defeated. And why was it defeated? It was defeated quite clearly, folks, because there hadn't been a proper business model put in place to justify, to talk about the disparities that currently exist. The reasons we need to move is because of A, B, C. This is what's going to happen, you know, D, E, F when we move, and this is what it's going to cost. But this is why we need to move. And anyone who's been to the public workyards know, as Ben Bird said, I mean, if this was a public school, you wouldn't send your kid to it. And yet we expect public employees of the town of Cobourg to go and work there in an area that's on a flooded plain, that's they're working in portables. I mean, you can go online and see the photographs of this facility, folks. It's desperate. We do need to move. But the reason it was defeated at council, why? Because it wasn't put forth in a proper fashion. They didn't put forth the actual reasons why it needs to move. We just need to move and it's going to cost this much money. That's what was presented.
And you know, what was interesting too is that, you know, the alternatives, you know, can we share space? I mean, there's a county works yard that sits at Elgin and Division,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, very large facility. Can that be shared? They've got salt domes there. They've got room for trucks there. There's space. Can we do something there? I mean, there's all kinds of opportunities. And not all the options were explored. So, you know, kudos to council. And interestingly enough, it was a band of new councillors,
mm-hmm.
that put the brakes on this thing. And it was good to see that, you know, some sober second thought was taking place. And I mean, it's so discouraging to see the same old voices coming up and making the, you know, the tired arguments,
mm-hmm.
that, well, this is the way we've done, and it's so obvious, and everybody, it's a wink and a nudge. And, you know, it goes back to the same kinds of things that's going on with the Senate and the Duffy case. We're seeing, mm-hmm. how this wink, wink, nudge, nudge attitude seems to proliferate in government, where, you know, we all know what's going on, so the public doesn't need to know. We're not accountable.
Right. We're all on that page.
We're all on that page. You know, who cares about where primary residence is? So here we are. So, you know, the same kind of thing I think is taking place here. You know, and while it must be frustrating for the civil servants, I think it's a clear message that, you know, let's tighten it up, let's get it right, and, mm-hmm. and let's start being a little more vigilant.
Well, and let's be sure to note, too, by the way, that this isn't the end of the story. I mean, all they really have to do is put forth a proper comprehensive business model for why it needs to be done, and then convince council that that's the right decision. If you do that,
yeah.
I'm confident that the decision will probably be changed, and that they will realize that, yes, it's necessary.
Well, and show some alternatives, you know, show some creative thinking, show some out of the box stuff, and let's show we've done our due diligence.
Absolutely. Well, my guest has been Rob Washburn. This has been Consider This Live on Northumberland 89.7. I'm Dave Glover. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to us here today. We're going to go out with our theme song, Everybody's Talking, here on Northumberland 89.7. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. I'll be back. Rob will be back next week as well. And we look forward to any emails or comments that you guys send us, because quite frankly, that's what keeps us going, in my opinion anyway. That's what keeps me driving along. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. Thanks, Rob. Again, and
Thanks, Dave. Here's
Harry Nielsen.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stopping still. I can't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes.